Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is World Forms and Fighting Champion John Chong, and you're listening to the AMAA Legends and Pioneers Radio Blog Show with Professor Gary Lee and the Sport Karate Museum Archives, protecting the history, one warrior at a time. Enjoy.
Aloha and mahalo, everyone. Welcome to the AMAA, Masters and Pioneers Radio Network. My name is Professor Gary Lee, and I am the creator and founder of the Sport Karate Museum. And for 3 years, you've allowed us to come into your home on a Tuesday evening and talk about sport karate heroes and pioneers and all kinds of good news and old news, introducing new ideas. It's really been a lot of fun these past 3 years. If you're listening, I'm going to ask you to do me a favor to mute your phone, and so there's no background noise. That'll help us a lot since we do a live podcast. I'll introduce my guest here in a few minutes, and I've got really something very special. But I'd like to share with you that this week we lost someone special in the Kempo family in the martial arts of America, representing true Kempo attitude with his incredible children and his family. We actually lost Ralph Castro. And I'd like to give 30 seconds to my show to Mr. Castro in the memory of what he gave to Kempo and to all of us, not only in the Kempo karate community, but in the community in general, for his love and dedication. And, we'll miss you, Mr. Castro. So 30 seconds for Master Castro, please. Well, thank you so much. Again, thank you for allowing us to come into your home again on a Tuesday evening. It's February 26th, and we've had some really bad storms here in the Houston area, but I hope you're safe wherever you're at, and everything's fine and dandy. You know, I appreciate, like I said earlier, that if you mute your phone if you're listening, because the background noise does pick up. But, you know, we're responsible for doing a couple things here on the show. One, to introduce the Sport Karate Museum Archives, and that is the basis of this show also, to educate people that sport karate originated somewhere. And also to introduce an idea that was actually introduced back in the 80s by Jan Wollendorf and Dale Brooks. It was Who's Who in Karate. And now it's the Who's Who in the Martial Arts. And it's spearheaded by Hunty Jesse Bowen. And for any information toward that, and toward the Legends Banquet and the various things that he's involved with, or to get a book, please go to Who's Who in the Martial Arts, and that's anywhere on your computer. Also, you can listen to our show through an iPhone or Android, and just type in AMAA Masters and Radio Network, and it'll come up, and you'll be able to listen to the show at a later date. You know, the neat thing about this show is I get to interview some of the incredible people. And, some of the incredible people aren't the people you always read about in the magazines and see the theaters. It's a lot of people in the background to make things happen for other people. And this tonight is about one of those gentlemen, a very dedicated teacher, you know, and trainer of martial arts excellence, a youth advocate, retired director of operations of the Chuck Norris's Kick Drugs of America organization, which now is a kickstart for kids. You know, this was a nonprofit organization that was created in the 1990s in the vision of Mr. Norris, and has helped thousands of kids in the Texas area learn goals, earn scholarships, and discover tournament skills, and along with the way, through hard work, achieve black belt. This group works with the youth and inner city school kids that would not be able to maybe go to a commercial studio. They have the best instructors, and they really care about teaching the same principles that Mr. Norris shared with us all those glorious years he was America's sport karate hero, and he still is. Well, when Mr. Ed Sines left the organization, he opened his studio, his own personal studio, and he is passing down his knowledge now commercially to the public. You know, when interviewing Mr. Science for this show, he said to me, as far as a martial artist from my time, I was very blessed that as a youth to see and train with not only Mr. Chuck Norris, but also some of his top instructors and students, you know, starting with Mr. Pat Johnson, you know, the choreographer for Ninja Turtles and The Karate Kid, and people like Howard Jackson, the first American, Afro-American that was rated number one. John the Tippethead, the Giant Killer. Later on, we'll be roasting him in Las Vegas in November. And watch them compete against all the greats of the time, Mr. Joe Louis, Mr. Bill Wallace, Mr. Benny Akitas. Enjoy this up-close and personal interview with a pure karate instructor, Mr. Ed Sines, a man of martial arts excellence. Well, Mr. Sines, are you there, sir?
Yes, sir. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate you being on the show tonight and just sharing with us your history and talking about some of the people that we both come across in our journey in the martial arts. So, first of all, you're in the Woodlands, right, of Houston?
I'm in Spring Tomball area. I'm in the Tomball Spring area, just under the Woodlands.
Okay. Now, you're also out there by one of your best friends and another cohort of Mr. Norris, Mr. Rick Perito, correct?
Yeah, he's in the Woodlands. So
okay. We're
neighbors and we're like brothers. We've known each other since the 70s. I made my black belt.
I will talk about him
in 1971.
I'm going to bring him up later because he's a really amazing guy. But let's talk about you first. Let's talk about when did you start martial arts, your first influence, and who was your first karate instructor? I'm going to give you a mouthful here. And when did you make black belt? So you got four answers there to give me.
Okay. I started in 1967. I started when I was 12 years old. My dad said to me and my brother, let's go do some karate. So all three of us started together. And like I said, I was 12 years old. 4 years later, 1971, when I was 16 years old, I had the privilege of testing in front of Mr. Norris and the board of directors at that time for my first three black belt. And at that time, I think 16 years old, you know, this is the early 70s and late 60s.
Right.
Youth, there weren't too many young people making black belt. They weren't giving black belts.
I think
kids.
Benny was one of the first people at 16 to make black belt in that time and age. And then guys like you, that it was pretty amazing. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there were some junior black belts they gave out, but it was interesting to be a black belt at that time because at 16, now you're not considered going into the adult division until you turn 19. Well, then you make black belt, you're an adult. So
right.
You started young going into the senior divisions because of that black belt.
Well, I guess you were around too when when you made black belt, you started competing in the California area. Is that where you started at?
Yes.
In California?
Southern California. Yeah. I started in San Diego, in Chula Vista, and my instructor was John Robertson. And in Mr. Norris's system, every black belt is numbered. So it identifies when you became a black belt under him. And my instructor was like the first generation under Mr. Norris. I can't exactly remember his number. I think it was like 14 or 15. And then I was more the second generation of black belts. My number is number 34. And now the numbers are.
Yeah, I like
4,
that. That's statistics. That's like playing baseball. I love it. That's what I love about baseball is that everything's statistically factualized. That's why I guess why I love the museum idea. That's cool. You're number 34. And
it identifies
Norris. Yeah.
Yeah, it identifies where you came in and who was your instructor in that time and your history right there, just with your black belt number within our organization.
Absolutely. Now, I've got to ask you a question because this is one of the things I got in my notes. Were you around when they first created the UF, United Fighting Arts?
UF? Yes. Yeah. In fact, when I made my black belt in 71, I actually got three different black belt certificates. I got one from Mr. Norris which at that time was the National Tong Sudo Congress. And then I got one from Wong Ki, from the Mudokwon from Korea. And then I got one from another gentleman, another master, Kim, I think it is, who was the head of the American Tong Sudo Mudokwon. At that time, I was right at the same time, we were still getting our ranks through the Korean organization under, you know, the founder of the Tong Sudo system, Wong Ki. In fact, I remember when I was a red belt, seeing Wong Ki visit Mr. Norris's school and watch a black belt test in maybe 69 or 70, just before I made
now,
my black belt.
What was the vision of UFAP in the beginning part? What was the vision of putting together the United Fighting Arts Federation? And there's a reason why I'm asking this, because I guess you remember the story I told you, but go ahead and tell me, what was the vision of Mr. Norris's group of putting UF together in the United Fighting Arts Federation?
Well, you know, when he came from Korea, it was a Tong Sudo was like, you know, just like Taekwondo, it was all kicks. And he trained with a lot of the Japanese masters in California and learned the hand striking movements. And he found that you need to mix your martial art. You need to bring out all the tools, not just one tool, and highlight one area. And so he wanted a system that's more rounded and involved with everything that's adaptable. So coming with that, and he separated from Korea, created his own organization, the United Fighting Arts Federation, kind of gives that understanding that we have a core to our system, which is very traditional, very historic. It has roots. It goes all the way through, all the way to Okinawa. But we're expanding it and making sure it stays complete in that aspect. And then later he brought in a system. He brought in a style name, which was Chunk of Dough. But then in the recent years, he wanted everybody to identify it more and help them understand the concepts of the style more. And he made the system go back to one of its original names, the Chuck Norris system. So we now practice the Chuck Norris system that's under the directorship of the United Fighting Arts Federation. So within our United Fighting Arts Federation, we have the Chuck Norris system, we have Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and we have Krav Maga as well. And you can get black belts in any of those martial arts.
See, that's really incredible, because it's that's my point. It's turned out to be one of the largest associations and groups in the world. And, you know, I'm going to share with the trivia with my listeners. You know, I actually went to the very first United Fighting Arts Federation tournament in Ohio, and I hitchhiked out there. And it was because of Mr. Bob Wall. And I got there late. I got there like 10:15. They already lined up the black belts for kata. It was mainly a lot of Tong Sudo people. And I sent a note down to Mr. Norris, and he really changed my life, Mr. Science. He could have said no, but he said, come on down. And I actually entered the tournament, took two third places, but remember staying in the best session overnight because I was so fascinated, because it was the very first time I'd seen snow. And it was my first time I ever met Mr. Norris. And I remember the judges. It was Mr. Norris, it was Aaron Norris, it was Ted Barth, the gentleman from Vietnam in the wheelchair, it was Leo Fong, and it was John the Tibbet Hat. And
there you go.
Yeah, and you know, we talk about history, that's history, and that's what I want to talk about you. You at 12, 16 years old, you got to see some incredible people that weren't superstars at the time, but you got to see them, be around them, actually probably work out with them. Who are some of those people that you were around?
Mike Stone.
Mr. Norris. Wow.
Mike Stone.
My original hero. Yeah.
Him and Mr. Norris started the Four Seasons tournaments, and originally those tournaments were just for red and brown belts and below, so the instructors, the competitors, can have an opportunity to kind of highlight their students. And eventually grew to the black belt competition too. But in the earlier days, it was just brown belt below. They had team green belt divisions, and they had team red and brown belt fighting divisions in the earlier days. It was before season.
Yeah, I know this is a hand-me-down story, because it comes down from what you saw or actually saw or heard, and now you're passing it on to me. But how tough was my brother, Mr. Stone? I heard so many different stories. I've heard so many different things. Tell me a story that you know how tough he was.
About who?
About Mike Stone.
Mike Stone? The story I heard about Mike Stone is he fought on the United States team one time against the Hawaiian team, if I remember correctly. And Chuck Norris and Mike Stone were on the United States team, and there was others. And there was a guy that was on the other team who fought with his, you know, in those days, we didn't have equipment, you know.
Right.
You just put maybe tape on your knuckles and tape around your fingers, and you just squeeze them real tight to make them stop hurting. And so this one guy was out there from my – I was told he had his hands open. It's kind of like almost having his finger pointing out. And Mike Stone told Mr. Norris, I'm going to break his finger. He reached out there and grabbed it and snapped it and took care of that one hand so he couldn't use it anymore.
Oh.
But he, you know, at the time, he's already finished competing when I started coming up through the ranks. He was just around. He was just,
right.
Just a neat motivating person, great shape all the time, and good in kata as much as he was in fighting.
Who was the toughest fighter that you had to fight growing up as a young fighter being around those greats? Besides Mr. Norris, you know, I mean.
Pat Johnson, you know, he was a strategic person, very strong, very aggressive.
You actually got to fight Mr. Johnson, really?
I used to take classes under him, so you would do drills with him back and forth.
Wow.
Howard Jackson was in the Marine Corps. When I met Howard, he was still in the Marine Corps, just stationed into San Diego area, and he was a black belt out of Detroit, I think it was, and he wanted to be his black belt with Mr. Norris. So they said, okay, work with the group that's in San Diego, John Robertson and his black belts, and they'll go through all the katas with you and get you ready for that material, and then you come up here and we work on fighting during the week, on the weekends. So I got to train with Howard once a week on sparring and everything in katas.
Wow.
I taught him katas. He taught me fighting. I was like 17, 18 years old. And so I was training with him, under him, preparing him for his black belt test into the Chuck Norris system. So that was a privilege.
Yeah. Well, you know, he vented me 1-2 close step. As far as I'm concerned, and as far as going back to the 70s, closing the gap, nobody could close the gap. When I interviewed Everett Van Monsignetti, known as the
Monsignetti. Yes, I remember watching him fight.
He told me that nobody, and I know that he was a big boy. He was 260, 6'3". He said nobody could close the gap like Howard. And, of course, Howard came from Detroit, as you know. And,
yes.
So he was up around Johnny.
He
Mayer
had that blitz.
Bob Hogan.
So
yeah,
he worked with me on how to blitz, the strategy of how to work a ring, how to work a match. You know, almost how to, you know, like a coach for a football team will have the first quarter, all the plays already planned out. He would do that with me. He says, this is what I want you to do first. This is what I want you to do second. This is what I want you to do third. This is what I want you to do fourth. He'll react this way, and each time he reacts, it's setting him up for the next thing you're going to do.
Well, for our listeners, just for the record, we're talking about the great Howard Jackson, and, you know, we lost him a few years back to leukemia. But Howard was the first Afro-American that was rated number one in America in fighting overall. And he also was an actor. He was
a world champion kickboxer. And then he was ranked in the top 10 in professional boxing.
Yes.
Well.
And one more story about Mr. Jackson. I know that he was going to be actually on the original team with Mr. Smith and Mr. Wallace and Mr. Lewis and representing America. And he hurt his knee. Was that correct? In a fight?
Yeah. He had a problem with his knee. I remember, from what I was told, He was really good at doing jump spinning heel kicks. Not like the people do now. I mean, this is where you get your hips head level and spin horizontal to the ground. And he would do a jump spinning heel kick and recoil and hit you with a round kick as he came down off that heel kick. Well, he came down and he slipped on a cup that was in the ring, and that's where his knee went out. And had issues with his knees from that.
I love talking about Mr. Johnson, and I love Mr. Johnson and Sue. They're just great people. And I'm talking about Howard. But let's go back to Mr. Science here now. Now, let me ask you a question. After you got involved with teaching karate and you maturing as a young black belt, you know, that was the time when Mr. Norris was getting involved with acting and television and, well, movies before the television.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get involved with that? Because I know you were involved with that also. Tell me how that came about.
That didn't, for me personally, that didn't happen so much until much later.
Okay.
I was in California.
Kick Drugs of America? Was it before Kick Drugs or was it after?
It was kind of about the same time it all started.
Okay, good.
See,
okay.
From California, I went to Virginia, and I was teaching in two schools out there called the Chuck Norris Karate Studios.
Right.
And then Mr. Norris contacted me to ask if I would like to come to Houston to help start at that time, Kick Drugs Out of America, which is now Kickstart
Kids.
What year was that? I came out in November of 91, and the program started in January of 92.
Yes, yes.
And in November of 91, when I came out, we were filming the movie Sidekicks. And that's where I was in the...
Yes.
And, you were all involved in that. And people, it was pretty cool because we were able to bring some of the top people from the Houston area.
I want to go back to before we talk about Sidekicks, because there's so much with just thinking about Ed Science. I want to talk about Kick Drugs of America, which now is Kickstart and a huge organization now that I talked about earlier in the introduction. When it was Kick Drugs of America, I remember at the same time I was doing Kids Expo at the Astrodome. And I remember getting involved with the movie also. But you know what was really cool about it was that we were introducing the idea, and I say we because, you know, I was involved with a lot of the early instructors that you put together. And it was exciting to go inside the inner schools knowing that a lot of these kids would never have the money to take karate in a commercial school. But they would have an opportunity now to be around some of these great karate instructors, these early guys, Mr. Gifford and Wade Kirkpatrick and just the amazing guys from the early days, and learn the way that Mr. Norris wants to pass it on. That vision to me to this moment so fascinates me, and I'm proud to be part of that beginning level. You were an director at that time, correct?
We started with four instructors, and I was one of the first four instructors.
Okay.
And
who were the other three?
Rick Prieto and Robert Sapp and a man named Gil Coppersmith, another Chuck Norris black belt from this area. Robert Sapp was came with me from Virginia.
Great guy, Robert Sapp. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
Great fight.
And we were the first four that started the program. We're in four different schools. Three actually in Houston, and one was in Galveston. And then later on, we brought in John Kirk to be the instructor down in Galveston. Rick Prieto was
a great fighter that was under you guys for years. He still is. A young kid, but now he's an old guy, was Derek Stinson. I remember him when he was just a kid. Yeah, he was like 10, 11 years old.
You were the first students from the program down there. Yes.
Yeah, real proud of him. But we can go on with the instructors, but as the director, or not the director, one of the four guys, what was your vision to make it more schools, or more opportunity? What was the vision of what you guys were doing?
Well, first off, just to be able to teach like that, it was a huge emotional impact on me because I came from a very commercial school in Virginia, and to go to a situation where, like you said, these children couldn't afford the type of karate that we were teaching in before, the schools we were teaching at, and the prices they charged for them, and the programs that was at, and the level of instruction that these commercial schools at that time, you know, where we came from, we're doing, and to come in and now not worry about sales, not worry about anything but making a difference with your karate. It felt like going back to karate in its purest form. Where it was like family, you just shared it with each other, you know? And you were making a difference with the history with these children, and you made them part of something bigger than just doing karate. You know, they were not only able to take martial arts from all these different great instructors, but they became part of Mr. Norris's family of martial arts. And there's a lot to because of that. And so you go in there and you see their environment, and you see the attitudes of they believe this is my future, this town and neighborhood, this area right here. And you open up their eyes and say, no, your future is the whole world, because martial arts is a world thing, and you're going to get access to the best martial arts no different than anybody else. And it brought, you know, it changed children's lives. They jumped on that, and
let me
provided a family and protection.
Mr. Stein, let me stop you right there. Let me say this publicly. You not only changed lives, you personally and your group, but you personally have changed lives just from what you just said. I know it's just all about one kid at a time, but you got to reach hundreds of kids. And today, when I do these shows, I just recently did one for Chelsea Clark, and she did her first tournament that she's ever done before. It was a super spectacular event, lots of Kickstart kids, but a lot of the grown-up guys that are still part of Kickstart came up to me, and you changed lives, Mr. Sines. So I'm so proud to be part of that beginning part journey of what you guys had a vision of. Now, you did it for how many years, and then you decided to open your own school. What year was that?
Opened my own school in 2011, so it'll be eight years this August. And it was time to do something. I'm an instructor. I can't do anything without teaching. And
yes, sir.
And I learn from my students. So when I don't have a student, I'm not learning. So I got in a position where I wasn't teaching anymore. I was just overseeing things and feel detached and not fulfilling what God made me to do. And it was time to maybe open up my own school. And it just all fell in place. And Mr. Norris helped me get it started. He was part of my grand opening. And
I remember.
I've been here now almost 8 years now.
And, well, let's talk about one of the last projects that you were involved with before he became a Texas Walker Ranger and ran that for some years. There was a movie that we talked about earlier, and it kind of changed the Houston level of thinking about martial arts, because he only brought the top champions from around the state of Texas. He brought in people from all around the country, but it was a lot of fun. It was called Sidekicks, and you were a major part of that to help create that atmosphere in the Houston area. Tell me the vision of that movie and what was the atmosphere like being around all those real champions of karate?
Man, it was like an opportunity to be part of Texas. I was born in Texas. I was born down in Corpus Christi, and my dad moved to California, and I grew up in California. But being part of that made me feel like I'm back to be in Texas again and part of Texas history. And because all those people that were there were all Texas history, you know, from Master Robles to, you know, it just went on and on with all the different people that were there. So it's really neat to learn about Texas martial arts from the original people that were there in the movie. And then to help train Joe Piscopo for the movie part, that he was the bad
that was
instructor
so funny.
Type of thing. He was a riot.
Yes. You mentioned earlier a gentleman named Robert Sapp. I remember a fight scene where he actually was fighting Mr. Norris, the first fight before he fought Mr. Piscopo. And Robert was a good fighter off the mat, too, in real karate tournaments, I remember.
Yes.
How do you get involved with being one of the four?
I'm sorry?
He was a big guy, but how do you get involved with being one of the first four? Was he just one of the
He was an instructor in Virginia with me. I was in one of the schools.
Okay.
He was in one of the schools, and we used to work out together a lot. And when Mr. Norris called me and asked me to come to Houston, I suggested bringing him if he needed another instructor, and he said, yeah. And that's how he got started from the very start.
Wow. And now, he's real close.
He's made his own
history. Dorsey. Yeah, Mr. Troy Dorsey. Yes. He actually worked with Mr. Dorsey, and they're real close. And so, yeah, I like Robert a lot. Now, Psychics had a huge premiere, and you got to showcase a lot of the people in the Houston area. But Psychics really changed the industry a little bit because it was the first introduction to sport karate for the general public and to the mass media. And do you realize how much of an impact that Psychics made on people?
No, you don't know what happens until it happens, I think. You know, we're just being ourselves out there.
Yeah. Well, you did change some people's lives. What's going on right now with inside your teaching everything? You've got any other projects going on besides teaching full time?
Basically, I just teach martial arts. You know, I teach the Chuck Norris system. I also teach at Krav Maga. This last March, I've had the privilege of earning the rank of a black belt in Krav Maga. And so a lot of my martial arts now is geared toward personal self-defense, personal protection, especially as crazy as the world's gotten lately.
Yeah.
Expanding our old karate into modern situations, modern weapons, the guns and knives and the environment that we're in, how our karate through this Krav Maga strategy applies to how to defend yourself under these type of stresses now.
If someone's doesn't know what those two words mean, like if I got a listener who's a beginner or someone who's done karate, explain to them what Krav Maga is.
Well, Krav Maga is a system of self-defense that was developed by the Israelis. You got a little bitty country in the Middle East that's surrounded by all these countries that are hostile toward it and want to, you know, destroy that little country and all the people in it. And so in that part of the world, that in Israel, every person that turns 18 has to serve 2 years in the military. And so they needed to train them in an effective self-defense that can be done that day. So it works with gross motor skills. It works with being under high stress. It works with taking advantage of your reflexive motion and programming yourself that you will need to attack this attacker who's attacking you with a level of violence that you need to surpass. Your violence needs to be greater than his, and your destruction needs to be greater than his. So it's a very aggressive form of martial arts, and it's done very quickly, and it's done at a very close range of self-defense positioning, nose-to-nose type fighting. In learning it, it's simple, and it's easy to understand. And if you have martial arts core, traditional karate, you go, oh, that's all karate. But it's applied to new modern type of situations, which makes it really very effective. One of the most effective fighting strategies, I think.
Well, there's lots of martial arts schools
that can get in the way of self-defense.
There's lots of Krav Maga schools in the Houston area. How do you know which one to pick?
It's best to
like
where he got
black belt karate schools. I mean, some are good, some are bad.
As always, like, you know, when you and I meet someone and we go, if we're not familiar with who they are, the first thing we ask is, who is your instructor? Or who is your instructor? And if you're not familiar with it, who was his instructor? We go back up the line. Eventually, when it's a core system of martial arts, it runs into someone you know. And the same thing here. Who taught this? Did you learn it from someone? Did they show you these moves? Or did you just get it from a video or a pamphlet or whatever? You know, so it has a history and it has a lineage that keeps itself up to date. Because the self-defense world, it's the same thing. You know, people attack you in the same manner, but they're becoming more strategic in how they apply themselves, and so you need to be keeping up with what the possibilities of an attack could be now.
How important, you talked about lineage a little bit, but I'm going to ask you, how important is that lineage to be able to pass that on to someone that you train so they know. How important is that to doctors? I mean, Mr. Science.
To me, it's pretty important because your original systems didn't work with what style they were. They worked off principles. They work off a principle-proven base, a core. And then from there, things can expand out. A lot of times people work on the fringes. They work on the latest technique or the latest move or the latest gimmick move or the latest deception move. And all that is good. All those work fine until you run into a real core person and you got to beat them with pure quality skill. Well, if you don't have core skills, core understanding how to make your body work and generate power and move and how to use your footwork to transport yourself around, you'll get shut down. And so I think, especially in the self-defense aspects, your grandmasters didn't create things for you to go out there and get hurt. They created things for you to be able to live with and survive with. And if it's not working, then you need to go back into its history and find out better interpretations and understandings of it and then how it applies to modern day.
How do you feel about that word that's been thrown around now like a dime a dozen? Grandmaster. I mean, share with me and my listeners, how do you feel about that word?
It's funny. If you need, when I teach a class of black belts, I do it shorts and a t-shirt. I don't need a belt. And if I need a belt for you to respect me, then what I have to say is should be more important than what I have on, and what I can show you to do, or how I can impact you to do better, should be the difference, not the belt I have on. Belts to me are important, and ranking and titles are important, but most of the times it's important within your organization of directional responsibility. You know, if you're a grandmaster, that means you have a responsibility over a governing body of people. And if you're a master, you have a responsibility of instruction to a group of people. They're positions of responsibility. So if that title or that rank or that position is valuable for that, you know, I respect that. And if you invested your time and knowledge to develop yourself, I respect that. It doesn't really matter what you call yourself to me. It's what you know that's more important, you know. It doesn't put the belt on you. You put the belt on. You know, you wear it. You are it. It's what you think and feel and what you know and can do and understand and share. There's the mastery is that, not in the belt.
Good answer. Well, we're going to stop with that thought. We're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back and play the Legends Name Game, where I'm going to hit you with a couple names, and you tell me how they influence you, or you influence them. It's like a fight. 2 minutes of talk about some of the favorite people. So we'll be right back with you, okay, Mr. Science?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Super. We're talking to Mr. Ed Science and one of the direct black belts that was tested under Mr. Chuck Norris, but now making his own recognition, and has for many years, but in the Houston area, having a karate school, a commercial school, and we're talking about his incredible history and some of the things and his vision of helping youth and adults and talking about karate. It's a lot of fun. Well, you know, we're going into our third year, and last year we started a segment with someone that is controversial within himself, but, hey, he's number one in his divisions and competition. He trained with Mr. Joe Lewis for many years until his passing, and then he was adopted by some crazy Hawaiian a few years back. And he does have an opinion, but we have a segment here called Kicking with the Wolverine. And we talk about subjects that sometimes people don't talk about, and we kind of discuss it among ourselves. So at that time, I'd like to bring on Mr. Wolverine, better known as Mr. Dean Piles. Hey, Wolverine, are you there?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Well, how are you, sir? How was the Compete Nationals? How was California?
It was great. We had a good time. We had a great trip out and a great trip back. Come right back.
Well, I guess
in.
I got a beef to pull with you. Listen. I'm going to right off the bat, I got a beef to pull with you. I was watching the live broadcast and watching my friends from Century and Sport Martial Arts doing the live broadcast. And Mr. Carnahan and Maurice, the great guys who helped run NASCA, they recognize some of the most important awards at these major events. And one of the most important awards that was given out this past year was a Triple Crown Award, where you won the U.S. Open, the Diamond Nationals, and this tournament. And he got everybody on stage. Everybody was there to receive that beautiful award from Larry Carnahan and the people from NASCAR, except for one person. Guess who that person was?
Me.
You were on the road, though, right? Heading back to Florida.
Yes.
I know,
yes,
I know.
Sir.
Well, congratulations to be a Triple Crown winner. That's pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Thanks,
well,
sir.
You know, tonight I have a subject that's interesting, and it's the old school guys are going to understand. The new school guys are probably going to be mad, but that's just the way it is. You know, Kumite fighting sparring tag. I'll say it again. Kumite fighting sparring tag. You know, from 1960 to 2019, you know, many moons ago. You know, when karate was a belt, they invented a word that described the violent part in practice and to demonstrate your skill that you have created within your mind and your body. That word was called kumite, and the word kumite was born. You know, it was part of the foursome. There was kihan for basics. There was kata for pre-range movements. There was bunkai for the self-defense. And then there was kumite. Kumite was born. And then someone said, whatever moons ago it was, competitive karate matches, it could be done. And it was invented. And then through America tournaments and amazing vision of some of the super producers in America, Mr. Ed Parker, Mr. Alan Steen, Mr. Aaron Banks, just to name a couple, it became another name. And they changed it from kumite to fighting divisions. And through the years, it became more passive. It became watered down, became non-aggressive. And they went to the word sparring, to have a sparring event. And then to the words I hear now, and I really despise the most. It really bothers me the most. Let's go out today and score some points and tag him first. I'll say that again. That's what my kumite, my fighting has turned to be. My sparring, even though that's watered down, but my kumite has turned to be, let's go out today and score some points and tag him first. When did karate become a game? When did karate become tag, you're it, drop your hands, if you get hit, tempers fly? When did sport karate only become only three techniques? Side kick, reverse punch, a front jab to the body. Huh? Just simply tag, you're it, attitude. When did judges start wearing T-shirts? No offense against my Hawaiian brothers, but Hawaiian shirts, and cut off shorts to judge black belts or any division. You know, it has changed and I am sad. However, I do remember. You know, I do remember. And understand things must be changed and for so-called improvement in the sport. You know, real karate people understand fighting is fighting, no matter if it's a tournament, a parking lot, or a backyard. And you cannot cover it up with rules or umbrellas. You know, I wish the best. I only wish they could get back to the kumite or fighting in the sports karate and bring back a little fear that used to be there. You know, when you used to line up and they go, line up. Oh, wait a minute. I forgot. They don't do that anymore either. Well, Marine, how you feel about it?
Well, you know, being back from Grandmaster Lewis's age, you know, I come up taking those hard hits, and karate has changed over the years. Now, you know, in my fighting division now, in the older fighting division, those guys still have a lot of technique. And it really surprises me to watch the 40, 50-plus, 60-plus guys, and they're coming up with combinations and techniques, and you look at the younger guys, and it's a 1-2. It's a back fist, reverse punch, back fist. Everything is the same thing. It's called a blitz, 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 blitz. But it's just the same technique, and it's who can get that technique first. It may be set up with some footwork, but as you say, it doesn't have that hard hit. And the reason why, you know, one of the reasons why is at first, you know, promoters, at the first tournament, nobody had pads. There were no pads. So people were getting more injured. So the amount of people coming to compete started going down and going down. So then they got the gloves. You know, Grandmaster Jing reinvented the gloves, and then so, you know, everybody had the gloves and sounded like it had plastic bags in them. And but, you know, it did take some sting off, and it added some stuff, but yet still the people were getting hit harder and harder, and numbers were dropping down. So then they started
Wolverine.
Yeah.
Wolverine, listen to me. It's karate. It's empty hand combat.
I'm not arguing with you.
No. I understand the change. I understand. But, you know, what I saw these past couple of weekends at major tournaments is something I've been watching for the past 5 years. It's turned into a game of tag. They've taken that word kumite and they've turned it to a game of tag first. Now, don't even mention the blitz. I understand. What they call blitz is not the same blitz that Mr. Sines was talking about when we were talking about Howard Jackson. Because I know from watching Mr. Jackson and watching those people who created that blitz and followed in his steps, they would always hit with that last technique after the full blitz. So the day blitzes I see, it blitz with a game of tag. And you know what gets me the most and gets me really fired up is that the judges, whoever's running the center, or even the corner judges, they just say stop, and the fighters stop. They assume that there's no fear anymore in what they call a karate tournament. So that's what I'm saying, and we can go on and explain the difference of going from nothing, bare knuckle, to pads and that thing. But the bottom line is they've changed it so much that it's embarrassing for anybody that did train in the old karate tournaments. And I know that people don't want to talk about the past, and they say, well, that's the old days, and they're all has-beens and stuff like that. But if you go to YouTube and you watch some of the fights, say, from 80s back, 80s and 70s, it wasn't tag. It wasn't stop. And the referees were working actively, and they wore uniforms to judge. To this day, I remember exactly, I won't say what tournament it was, but I bowed out because the guy was running the tournament in a pair of shorts and was eating a hamburger, and he was trying to bow us in. It's about respect. You know, if you come to a tournament, act accordingly. So,
Yeah, and back in the day, you know, in the 70s, 80s, everyone had on their front windows of the karate school, full contact karate. Well, that got taken away because, look, this is a past Grandmaster Joe Lewis.
You know why that got taken away? Hey. That got taken away because of the boxing commission and the word full contact, okay? Any boxing commission that ran a state, they were in control of any type of contact. Listen, I hate to cut it short, but, you know, our segment is on a time schedule. I've got to cover some other commercials. I love talking to you. I wish you the best.
Yes, sir, no problem.
I know you're revamping your house. And, you know, talking about those words, kumite, fighting, sparring, tag karate. Think about
well,
it.
Well, that's why it's not called kumite anymore.
They think that's they think it's sushi. That's what they think. That word sushi means. So.
Yeah.
Thank you, Wolverine. God bless you. You stay safe. Keep training. Make Mr. Lewis proud. You make me proud every day. I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
God bless you.
Puss.
Hey, well, you know, we got a couple of things we want to mention. I've got Mr. Larry Fields' 20th Annual Wild West Tournament, Karate and Breaking Championships at the Abilene Convention Center. And this is 1100 North 6th Street in Abilene, Texas. There's going to be $1,000 expense money and prizes for the adults and junior grand champions. This is April the 6th. This is an AOK rated event. You got forms, sparring, grappling, and demo. Mr. Larry Fields, if you don't really remember him, if you've been living under a rock, he's one of the top breaking champions in the world. Not the state or a few states, but the world. He's proven this. He's been on television shows. He's been at major tournaments. He's dominated breaking with a handful of people. So this is Larry Fields event, April the 5th and 6th. And this will be at the amazing Abilene Convention Center. Then next week, I've been asked, and this is something I'm very excited about because I don't get to ask very much, but they're really cool. I'm going to the 20th Annual Warrior of God Martial Arts Championships, Saturday, March the 9th. 2019. And this will be at the Kilgore High School Gymnasium and at the Longville Street in Kilgore, Texas. Now, the neat thing about this place, what's going on, they're having a tournament. It's a 20th annual championships. We're also going to have the Sport Karate Museum booth. And also, March the 8th at the dojo, I'll be having a special training class going over sword technique, bunkai, application kata, a traditional karate class, all ages, and children will be $30, adults is $40. And for contact information, please call 901-824-5716 and ask for Teresa, and she'll give you all the directions and all the information to be there next Friday for Professor Gary Lee's Seminar Training Center. You know, we have a couple events coming up that I've got to mention. June the 29th at the Bellagio in Las Vegas, the Who's Who Martial Arts Banquet will be produced by Mr. Jesse Bowen, honoring the book cover for Mr. Stephen Hayes and honoring his career in bringing jiu-jitsu to America, and one of the founding fathers. Also, guest speaker will be myself and my co-host, samurai, Mr. Dana Abbott, and we'll be talking about our movie adventure with Memories of American Samurai. The following day, July 1st through the 3rd, at the incredible Bellagio, the Century Super Show, the largest martial art industry show in the world, will be going on, and we'll have our incredible booth there. I'll have special guest Paul Pawala from Warrior Magazine, Mark Johnson from Tactical Gear, also Mr. Jason Brooks, Mr. Jim Buten, who's always been there every year, will have his book, and will be representing the Sport Karate Museum July 1st through the 3rd. Then we'll be coming back to Houston, and Houston will be September the 27th, 28th, and we'll have the Hawaiian Living Legends, the 28th one, and the roasting of, some lucky Hawaii boy. But we'll also have a History General Summit, bringing some major history generals together, Tactical Flavor Seminars, the Professional Maximizer Awards, headed up by none other than Robin Shockley. And then in November, first and second, who you just heard tried to call me, my dear friend John Natividad. His incredible roast we'll have at the Samstown Gambling Hall and Casino in Las Vegas, November 1st and 2nd, and more details will be following that. These are some of the information, things that are coming up dealing with the Sport Karate Museum archives. And remember, for more information, go to www.sportkarateMuseumArchives.com, and you can follow us or us on Facebook, and follow us on the AMMA Masters Radio Show and Radio Network, or Professor Gary Lee, and or also the Museum of Sport Karate. So we'd love to hear from you. Drop those emails, and we'll be coming back with our emails here pretty soon. They're building up as we go. So I'd like to bring my special guest back on, Mr. Ed Sines, and we'll be talking the Legends Name Game. Mr. Sines, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Well, you know, we got lots going on, but, you know, the neat thing about the Legends Name Game is invented by a great fighter from California. You remember Bob White?
Yes, I remember
Bob White and I invented this at the very show. He was my first interview. And since that time, I've interviewed over 200 people. And What it is, it's like a sparring match. For 2 minutes, you get to talk about a person I throw at you, and we kind of trade stories if I have a story with them. But it's really talking about your history with that person. So are you ready to play the Legends Name Game?
I'll do my best. We'll see.
Here we go. I'm going to throw the first one at you. John Natividad. He just tried to call me, by the way. I got to call him back. But tell me about John Natividad.
I grew up idolizing him. I used to watch how he did his kicks. I used to try to copy every kick he did. He would cruise across the floor on 1 foot doing round kicks and heel kicks across people's face. I tested for my second degree, 17, 18 years old, and Mr. Natividad was testing for his second on the same test. And I sparred with him for my second degree black belt. And it was the most exciting thing I've ever done, was fighting against him at that time, at that age.
Well, you know, him and Mike are one of my two original heroes from Hawaii. My favorite story that I'll be telling at his roast is I hitchhiked to Honolulu just to get his cover on the cover of the magazine. And
I remember I watched him. Go ahead. I'm just going to say I watched him fight for grand champion at the Internationals against Benny Rakitas, and it was three rounds.
Yeah.
It was three rounds of cumulative points. At the end of three rounds, the score was tied 13-13 and went into sudden death overtime, and Mr. Natividad got the first point and won the grand championship.
And you were there.
Yes, I was there. I watched the whole thing.
Wow.
I was, like I said, a kid.
I got one picture of that great fight, and I treasure it. And it was signed by Benny and John. And you were there.
Wow.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
That's recorded as being the longest overtime in the history of our sport.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, wow. How old were you when you were there? How old were you?
Oh, I must have been, I don't know, 17 maybe? Maybe 18? Maybe younger, I don't know.
Let me throw another old timer at you who I'm very close to, but I know that you know, I don't know what you dealt with him. This is a surprise. Duke Tershall.
Duke Tershall?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know Duke. Yeah.
Okay, tell me a story about Duke, because he was a great fighter, great judge.
Yeah, great.
Good actor.
Nice guy. He used to train with Mr. Norris a lot. I was training down in San Diego. Yeah. I remember we came up for a workout, and it was like all these black belts together. I had a team. I think he was the captain of the other team. And I remember sparring against him. And I was lucky that day. I scored the most points.
Oh, cool. What about Darnell Garcia?
Oh, my gosh. Between him and Howard Jackson and Pat Johnson, those three influenced me the most on the strategy of fighting. He wasn't necessarily, he was a good athlete and great fighter, but it wasn't his athleticism that got you. It was his strategies, his knowledge and how to play your weaknesses. You know, he fought Joe Lewis for grand champion. I think he won at the Internationals one year. Because he just knew how to read you. Position, he knew what foot to put in front of you to put you at a weakness.
Tell me because you were around him apparently, and you know, this past year, John Natividad and I from together received the Joe Lewis Eternal Award. Tell me a Joe Lewis story. Do you have one?
Mr. Norris put on a tournament one time in L.A., and Joe Lewis came and competed in it. And I remember lining up, and there was this man, I don't know who he was, where he was, who got an attitude with Joe Lewis. Started mouthing off to him. And what's up with that guy? I found out that he felt that he fought Joe Lewis at another tournament, and the judges ripped him off on points. He felt that they gave favoritism to Joe Lewis, and he said that to his face. Well, I don't know if it was set up or what, or it just worked out. He got his wish to fight Joe Lewis again, which was a mistake. You couldn't hit the face with punches, couldn't make full contact, but you could hit the head. Joe would grab his shoulder, spin his shoulder to the side so his head would spin around, and he'd hit him almost full power in the back of the head. You'd think his eyeballs would pop out. He grabbed him by his lapel and then grabbed him by his pants and picked him up and piledrived his head into the ground. I mean, he just proceeded to stomp. There was no question on who won that match. You didn't need judges to get points.
Without a doubt. Now, you got to see all sides of Mr. Lewis, correct?
Off and on. I mostly knew him from when I saw him compete in tournaments because he trained with the guys in L.A. mostly, and I was down in San Diego. And, again, I was young at that time. I wasn't, like, one of the big guys.
You know what? I was like yourself and many, 99% of people. that realized that Mr. Lewis was in a different caliber, and he was very, very authentic in what he did and said, and he was very strong. And I was at the Super Grands in Savannah, Georgia, and I was helped inventing Black Belt TV and was doing commercials and stuff. And Garrett was very young, and I was hanging out with Mr. Keeney and Mr. Wallace, and, you know, we was doing a bunch of stuff, but I had to do these commercials. And I had nobody to babysit Garrett. And out of the blue, Mr. Lewis goes, he can stay with me. And I didn't want to impose on Mr. Lewis, but I didn't say no. I said, sure. So I'm gone for almost 2 hours, Mr. Sines, you know. And I come back, and in the distance, I see Garrett on Mr. Lewis's knee, and they're just having a good time. And I saw a part of Mr. Lewis the next day because he took us to breakfast, Garrett and I, the next morning before he went back to North Carolina. And he got to share with me and talk and get a bunch of stuff for the museum. And I'm really glad I got to see that part of Mr. Lewis that everybody talked about, but yeah. I got to see it. So that's cool. Now, you talked about someone earlier who I remember after I got to know him after Sidekicks, I went back in all the Chuck Norris movies, Mr. Norris's movies, and I went back to pick him out. And I'm talking about Mr. Rick Pirito. What a great guy. What a great guy.
Yeah, he's a super guy. He's like a big brother.
Well, tell me a story about Mr. Pirito, because he hung out with me at the Super Show last year, him and his lovely wife, Lacey, and we got to talk a little bit. I actually gave him one of my books. But tell me a Rick Pirito story. Cool.
Well, I remember I watched his black belt test when he tested. I think he tested in 72. He was just after my black belt test. I was in 71, and I think he was just the next group after me, and maybe in 72. He was one of the first instructors to go to Virginia to start the Chuck Norris Studios out there. And when I came out there to teach, he was like a big brother, always made sure I was okay and guided me along, and has always been my support. I remember I took a little bit of a sabbatical from the system, and I was teaching. I got involved with some Okinawan martial arts. I was teaching for a man named Frank Hargrove on the East Coast and another one named Noel Smith, which are students of the founding system of the Shonryu. And I was teaching Shonryu Okinawan karate for a while, which was really good because you find out your roots and where it comes from and how it expands to where you are right now. And then I came back and I was teaching within the Chuck Norris Studios, and I remember coming to the convention in Las Vegas and seeing all these people I didn't know. It's like, it's really strange. You knew everybody because you grew up, and then you come back and there's all these hundreds of people that you don't know. And I saw Mr. Prieto, and I said, yeah, wow, someone I know. He says, I feel really strange. I'm here and nobody knows who I am. He says, oh, it won't take long. He was the one that brought me to Houston. You know, he was the one that told Mr. Norris where I was at so I can come to Houston and be part of the Kickstart.
Tell me about Mr. Norris's younger brother, I believe, is Mr.
Aaron?
Aaron is younger, right? Is younger or older?
Yes. He had two younger brothers.
Okay.
There's three brothers.
Okay.
There's Whelan Norris and then Aaron Norris. And
Whelan
was a black belt as well.
Vietnam, correct?
And he was killed in Vietnam. And then Aaron was the youngest. He's just a few years older than me. And
now,
he also served in the
Army. About Aaron, and this is good. Everyone knows Aaron to be a great director and stuntman, but what people don't remember is that
he was a great fighter.
Yes.
He won the Battle of Atlanta for his weight division one time. He won the Battle of Atlanta.
Okay, cool.
But he was a combination fighter. We were brought up, never throw one punch. There's always punches and bunches. And a blitz to us means you did one step and three strikes at one time, one right after another within one step. And you followed up from that point on. We had multiple footwork and multiple striking techniques. And going from the West Coast, where people are more accustomed to seeing multiple strikes in a combination, to the East Coast, where we're a little more traditional of seeing more one strike at a time, it was frustrating because you would throw three or four punches and a kick on the end and come down with a hand strike on the end of that. And one judge will see the left hand, one judge will see the right hand, one judge will see the kick. And you get no point. And I go, wait a second, all of them got in. What's the deal here? So Aaron was that type of fighter. He threw things in combinations and used his aggressiveness to run over you, just like his brother. The brother, you do. If you, Chuck Norris, if you didn't stop him in the first move, you expect to have footprints up and down inside you. Oh,
so that gets me to my combination. Tell me a Mr. Norris story without getting real personal, but just something that could tell my listeners about Mr. Norris, about his fighting ability.
I watched him fight Skipper Mullins at the Internationals.
Cool. And, tell me about that. I've got goosebumps. Tell me about that.
Again, this is three, you know, they do the three rounds of cumulative points. At the end of the second round, Mr. Norris was losing. And Mr. Mullins was starting to do a little bit of the bicycling just to milk his lead. And going into the third round, and Mr. Norris told him, says, "Why don't you stand in here in the ring and fight like a man?" Well, that's all it took. You don't say that to a Texan. And
he said that?
Next thing you know, you see Skipper Mullins going three rows out in the audience where Mr. Norris did combination on him and just blitzed him, and he was out of the ring, all the way out of the off the stage and landing into the crowd of people. And Mr. Norris came from behind to win the title, the grand champion.
That is an incredible part of history and the story you're making. Now, did you fight that day too yourself?
Yeah, I was real young. I was just starting to get into the adult division, so I didn't last very long, but I was able to train with everybody and get it going. My development and my success didn't happen until a little later. On the East Coast, I was a Virginia State champion 2 years in a row, and then I was a member of the United States AU Karate National Team and AU World Team.
Cool.
It was kind of strange. Being from Mr. Norris, everybody looks at you as a Korean system, and that was
right.
A Japanese traditional tournament. And they go, "Aren't you under Mr. Norris?" I go, "Yes." And they go, "Aren't you Taekwondo?" I says, "Well, we were originally Tungsu, but we're not that now." He says, "You don't fight like a Korean style." I go, "I wouldn't win like a Korean if I fought like a Korean style in y'all's tournament." So
from tonight's interview, you kind of share with everybody that you not only trained in different styles, but around different great people. So, you know, back then we were all sponges, right?
I mean,
we just saw as much as we could. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, if it worked, it got incorporated.
When, you know, again, I got to say, because he's really my hero too. When did you realize that Mr. Norris was going to become great? I mean, you were around him from the time you were young, and he thought he was just another karate instructor. But sooner or later, being around him like you were, you realized that this was going to be a great man someday. When did it happen?
You just don't know how God blesses you. Like I told you, my dad said, "We're going to do karate." Of all the schools to walk into one that was one of his, when I tested for my belts, all my lower belts, I tested for every belt except for maybe two or three green belts in front of Mr. Norris. He graded me for all my belts and black belt too. And then when my instructor, John Robertson, was no longer in the organization, Mr. Norris became my instructor. And so coming up, and at that time, the magazine was Black Belt Magazine, and you saw him on the cover of that magazine with Joe Louis in a match in New York, and then you see where he won the Triple Crown, and then you see, you know, him being recognized as one of the greats of the Golden Era. And then you see him work hard to go into another field, apply that same attitude of, like he would say, "I maybe lose once by a certain way, move, but I won't lose twice. I will learn from that, and I won't ever lose twice again that same way." And he's applied that to his life and everything he does. He doesn't mean he doesn't get knocked down. He doesn't get knocked down twice the same way. And he learns from it and moves on, and applied that to the movie industry when everybody thought, "No karate person is going to be a celebrity," to suddenly becoming as well known as Bruce Lee all around the world, from his movies and to his TV show. You know, you can't think of martial arts without giving your respects to Mr. Norris.
Well, you know, it wouldn't be in my attitude unless I asked, because I know that she's been a big part of everything that he's done. And I got to meet her back when I roasted Mr. Wall many, many, many years ago. And, you know, last year when I honored 100 Black Belt women, I realized that women have played a really important part, whether they're Black Belts or not, but anybody involved with the martial arts. And I'm talking about Miss Gina Norris. Tell me about her and what she's done recently and what she's doing now to make Kickstart, you know, so powerful and so strong within the community.
Well, Mrs. Norris adopts it. It's not an organization or a nonprofit to them. It's their family. And so that's their passion. That's their purpose. You know, when you know that you're on earth, God has a purpose for you. And he wants you to do that thing to make a difference for God, even more than yourself. That's how her approach is to what she's doing with Kickstart.
Well, I hear nothing but great things in what she's done and what she's doing. And I just had to say a big shout out to her and thank you so much for what she's doing with the kids and what you did in the early days of the beginning part of Kick Drugs Out of America, which turned into Kickstart, and your vision to help kids one at a time, as we talked about earlier. Well, you know what I've done for 20 years to build this sport karate museum and kind of archive the history. How important is it to archive that sport karate history? People just take it for granted. Tell me your feeling about that.
Everything is built off of what you did before. You know, you can't get to where you are until you become what you are now. And if you forget about the past, it's a disrespect to appreciate what you have now. And, I got a few chuckles from what you were saying earlier about our era fighting compared to this tag era now. But, you know, I respect their athleticism. These modern martial artists are extremely athletic. They're an athlete, a martial arts athlete. You know, we might have been martial artists, but these guys are pretty athletic, and you have to admire that athleticism and the development and the science that they're applying to that one strike move type of movements. But you made me laugh when you talked about when people say break, they stop now. You didn't stop until someone grabbed you.
No. But I, you know, one thing I picked up on this past couple of big tournaments, that the center referee, literally, when he said stop, the fighters would stop.
He jumped in the middle.
Yeah, but the fighters just stopped, and they go back to the line. You know, you just didn't – I've never seen that before, but they just do it
you
normally.
You couldn't afford to just stop in our time. You get hit.
and you always
protecting yourself
first
until
hit last.
Someone got
hit
in the middle
first, hit
to stop
last,
for it.
Yeah, and you had to make your point so you could hear it, I remember, you know. You know, but it's okay. It's like you said, they're very athletic, and that's what it's turned out to be right now. It's turned out to be tag. I hope that the Olympics and WK, or what they do with the Olympics in 2020, when it's introduced, whether it stays or not, I hope that they see real karate do. I'm excited about the fighting part, Mr. Science, but you know what I'm excited about in the Olympics in Japan is that they're going to introduce kata. And I believe the world is going to be mesmerized by kata because they've never seen it before, like two kata.
So crisp, so fast, and so graceful.
Yes.
And I think the fighting you'll see is closer to the traditional style that you see in Japanese Okinawan style fighting, where the contact has to make impact and stun before it's considered a good point. So it's everything's bigger footwork than when our time came up, because the athleticism developed and the science of how to move is much better. But I think the shock value is still going to be involved to get a good solid point.
Sure. Now, for the decades you've been teaching, you would have told somebody something different, a different approach, if they walked into your karate school years ago. Now, if someone walked into your karate school in 2019, which you go down there every day, what would you say to them to get them involved with your school or any martial arts program? What would you say to them?
You know, what's your goals? What's your commitment to what you're looking for? If it's a real core-based system that develops you. I teach, like, in the three corners, art, sports, self-defense. I keep that balanced so that your development is pure all the time, and you have your respect and your history still tied to what you're doing, and you have what you learn, whether it's sport or whether it's self-defense, it all connects. You don't have to put on a different uniform. It all comes from the same center. And so I want to teach you how to create power and how to defend yourself.
So how would someone get in touch with Mr. Ed Sine, get involved with your karate school, and what part of maybe give them some information, your website and everything, so anybody's listening, you get in touch with you.
Yeah, my website is edsainsma.com. And, you know, it has everything on there from my phone number to my email and my location. And everybody's welcome to come visit.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show tonight. We've covered a lot of information and got to talk a little about history, which that's what I love to do. I tried to get in touch with John to call in, but, you know, he was doing a live radio show in California, in Las Vegas, the same time that we were doing it, and he just called me. And I gave him the number to the producer, but I don't know if he called in or not, or tried to or not, but I was trying to get him on the air.
Well, tell him hi for me when you talk to him.
Oh, I will, and like I said, I'll keep you in touch about what we're doing this year to honor him. But thank you so much for being on the show, and I appreciate your information. And maybe you get to come back sometime real soon, okay?
Well, thank you so much for thinking of me. Appreciate it.
Well, God bless you, Mr. Science. God bless you. We'll talk to you real soon, okay?
Have a good night. Bye-bye.
Hey, guys, we've been talking to Mr. Ed Sine, who, you know, is one of those incredible pure karate instructors that came from the lineage of Mr. Chuck Norris. And so that just kind of endorses everything that we've talked about through all the shows and the years that, you know, people like Mr. Norris, you know, is not just a movie star, not just in the limelight, but they came from real karate roots, and they trained real karate people for people to grow up like Golly Bum, literally grow up like Mr. Ed Sine. So, well, that was a really enjoyable show. Also, thank you to Mr. Wolverine for explaining and talking about his feelings toward Kumite and fighting and sparring and tag. And remember to support the tournaments that we advertise. Remember that we're here every Tuesday night. And for more information on the Sport Karate Museum, you can go to www.sportkaratemuseumarchives.com. Don't forget to support our Facebook fundraiser on Facebook. And check out, don't forget, Mako's Trivia Answers Challenge. That's right. You can ask any question, and Mako will answer the question for you. You know, we'll be talking about that more as we get involved with that. Well, as we say all to you, every Tuesday night, mahalo and aloha.